Welcome to Continental Media 0510, recorded November 25th, 2005. COM is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave, a supplement to my weekly World of Radio program. Continental Media is made possible by Universal Radio. For their catalog, call 1-800-431-3939 or check their website, www.universal-radio.com. You can also reach their website and check much other useful information at www.dxing.com. All from Universal Radio for quality, amateur, and shortwave equipment. Let us begin with something upbeat. This was posted on the shortwave SWL antenna Yahoo group by Robert W. Betts on November 7th about power line communications. BPL is a technical dinosaur. It cannot sustain high-speed transmission and is adversely affected by outside disturbances. It just won't work. It's really the various power companies' attempt at cashing in on what the cable and telco companies have been doing. The FCC must allow testing of the system, the technology, since it was proposed through all the legal channels and is a routine move within their fairness policies or manifesto. The BPL testing will or should convince the power companies that the technology is about 40 years out of date and will cost them a bundle of cash for the privilege of failing. They know it. The FCC knows it. The engineering world knows it. It's just a desperate move that will die a slow, agonizing death like disco. Apologies to the village people for that last remark. On his Future of Radio blog, October 24th, Harry Helms wrote this about the Senate committee approving an analog TV shutoff hard date. The real driving force now behind the conversion to high-definition TV is that the spectrum currently allocated to analog TV is urgently needed for next-generation wireless services, especially broadband. It's not too much of an exaggeration to say the most valuable real estate in America today isn't found in Manhattan or La Jolla, but instead is located around 700 megahertz. When the conversion to HDTV is complete, many new wireless services will operate on locally vacant HDTV frequencies. Several technologies in development will automatically search for locally vacant channels using a technique called dynamic spectrum allocation. The IEEE 802.22 standard now in development will define how most of these new services will use the new HDTV channels and coexist with HDTV. If you want to DX HDTV, better do it now. Even locally vacant channels are going to get a lot of QRM on them in another decade. But I suspect some of us are going to be DXing these new wireless services. Maybe utility DXing will enjoy a renaissance in the VHF-UHF range. Instead of AM or FM DXers, we might morph into WiMAX DXers or Media Flow DXers. While the analog TV shutoff date has been extended a couple of times, I think 2009 is going to be the absolute end this time. It's important to remember that you won't even notice the closure if you get TV via cable or satellite. And most households today, even those below the federal poverty line, have cable or satellite service. This is one of the most fascinating facts from the 2000 census. For those who rely on over-the-air reception, there seems to be a consensus emerging in Congress to provide converter boxes for those with a household income of less than twice the federal poverty line. With the economies of scale, manufacturers like Korea's LG say they can offer converter boxes at a retail price of $40 or less. In other words, you won't have to buy an HDTV set unless you want one. As with all consumer electronics, the prices of HDTV sets have been steadily dropping as sales ramp up and economies of scale kick in. Drop by somewhere like Best Buy or Circuit City on a weekend afternoon, and you might be surprised at consumer interest in HDTV and how rapidly sets are selling. As to whether HDTV is worth it, that's strictly a question of personal preference. We got our HDTV set, a Panasonic LCD model, in February 2004, and find it's more enjoyable for viewing DVDs than most HD programming. HDTV really brings out the limitations, such as lighting in the program source material. You can really tell which sports arenas and stadiums are poorly lit. HBO and Discovery consistently provide high-quality HD source material, while the four broadcast networks vary, but the trend seems to be toward improved material. But I can't figure out why TNT bothers with a HD feed. It's almost always grainy, even for shows like Law & Order that have been broadcast previously in HD on another network. But HDTV is great for watching DVDs. We've essentially stopped going to the movies. Why bother with parking, traffic, $6 bags of popcorn, $8 tickets, and idiots who don't know how to turn off a cell phone or stop talking during the movie when you can wait 3 months and rent the movie from Netflix? By the way, did you know the Navajo word for television is Beshbagoa, which means wallpaper that speaks? Says Harry Helms. Much more interesting reading at his blog. It's futureofradio.typepad.com. On the WTFDA sound-off list, this from Doug Smith in Tennessee. Amber alerts on EAS are stupid. One of the best safety tools one can have is a weather radio. Many of the recent tornado victims in Indiana may have been saved if they'd had such a device to warn them to leave their mobile homes before the approaching tornado struck. About an hour ago, I turned off my weather radio because about a sesquihour ago, the Tennessee Emergency Management Authority activated the EAS, that's the Emergency Activation System, and the weather radio for an amber alert. I guess there are no time stamps, but I mean 90 minutes ago, 2 a.m. A little girl was kidnapped about 100 miles east of here. They activated EAS statewide. What the H am I supposed to do about it? I guess they figure the kidnappers might choose my home out of the millions of homes in Tennessee, or break in and allow me to see their victim, and allow me to use my phone to call 911. And I suppose they figure that if someone breaks into my home at 2 a.m. accompanied by a little girl who appears to be present against her will, then I won't call 911 unless I'm aware there's an Amber Alert. The Amber Alert program is an important one. Certainly, we should use the media and the highway message boards to pass along the descriptions of kidnapped victims. To wake up the whole state over something none of us can do anything about, however, is to cry wolf. Those comments by Doug Smith in Pleasant View, Tennessee. Now about the idea for low-power AM in the U.S. Brock Whaley forwards this from allaccess.com. The National Association of Broadcasters has come out against the low-power AM proposal, working its way through the FCC. The NAB complains that the petition has too little evidence in favor of LPAM and would undermine the FCC's efforts to clean up the AM band from interference and would pose a competitive threat to AM broadcasting at a time the band is transitioning to digital. We'll include a link to the NAB's full comments. This reply came from Paul Swearingen in Kansas on the NRC AM list. How predictable, eh? For years now, the NAB has been a one-trick pony, only able to support their member stations and stifling any new competition. Clean up, indeed. The LPAM proposal, however, flawed as it may be, is not about competition. If I read it correctly, it's about making locally oriented community programming more easily available to communities which do not now have it. Delete the broadcast jukeboxes and national yada-yada programmers, and what would you have left in any market anyway? So will the FCC display the backbone necessary to support diversity programming in local communities? Stay tuned, but don't hold your breath. Blaine Thompson in Fort Wayne says this, regarding LPAM and the inner workings of the NAB, I'd be curious to know how many members the NAB has, how many of those are radio-only, and of those radio-only, how many own fewer than 10 radio stations? Once I had that possibly unattainable data, I would make a decision on the NAB's position on LPAM, as I'd have a hunch on how it may have formed an opinion. On his Future of Radio blog, Harry Helms inserts this headline, referring to the NAB comments, National Association of Broadcasters begs FCC, save our monopoly. The recent petition to create a low-power AM broadcasting service has, as was inevitable, drawn opposition from the NAB. What makes the NAB position especially mendacious is how they cite propagation factors and resulting interference as reasons to reject the petition. Yet the NAB has ignored those same factors in its eagerness to have IBOC HD adopted. Will the same political acumen that kept the wholesale price of beer artificially high be enough to defeat low-power AM? We plebes can only watch and hope for the best. He's alluding to the new head of the NAB, who was formerly a spokesman for the beer industry. Well, here's another way to have a local radio station, although it isn't really radio. Kevin Redding on the ABDX list found this in the Los Alamos, New Mexico Monitor of November 4th. Local radio now available through radio.com by Carol A. Clark. Lynn Blue of Los Alamos Sound has launched a local radio station over the Internet. Blue said, "Los Alamos needs a community radio station, so I decided to pick up where KRSN left off, and a month ago went live with losalamosradio.com. I'm trying to get people to realize we live in a computerized world. It's just as easy to have a radio stream coming out of your computer speakers as from a boombox. losalamosradio.com provides local news, talk radio, community events, sports, and a diverse mix of music." And he lined up several DJs. He came to Los Alamos in January 04, followed by his wife. They opened a music and sign store, which, along with the radio station, is at 146 Central Park Square. He's looking for sponsors and advertisers to move the station forward. Internet stations, unlike AM or FM, can maintain an accurate and up-to-the-minute count of listeners and where they are from because of the royalties we pay out, he said. His most recent printout shows listeners accessing the station from Italy, Sweden, Singapore, Japan, Germany, Bulgaria, Canada, and other countries. Los Alamos has been without a local radio station since KRSN AM 1490 closed its doors on July 5, 2005. KRSN goes back to the 1940s. It was part of the Manhattan Project. It changed hands. It died in the early 1990s, went off the air in January 97, purchased by a new owner back on the air July 4th, 97 to July 5th, 2005. But the latest general manager cited financial problems and an expensive lawsuit as the reason he had to shut KRSN down. Well, here's the website, www.losalamosradio.com. When I looked, I couldn't find any program schedule, however, and no sign of any local talk shows, which they supposedly have. I wish they'd bring back Spy Talk, which was a show on KRSN I always wanted to hear but never managed to. Another way to have a local radio station is simply go on the air. If you have enough political clout, the FCC will leave you alone. That's happened so far with 1710 AM in Brooklyn, New York. Often referred to as Lubavitcher Radio, George Zeller in Ohio in Free Radio Weekly wrote this about Radio Moshiach and Redemption. That's M-O-S-H-I-A-C-H. It was heard October 29th and 30th from 23:53 past midnight 21, probably universal time. A man was talking rapidly, mostly in what appeared to be Yiddish, but there were some English words mixed in. Once in a while, a crowd would respond, as if this was a religious service. I heard no music during the period, and there was no clear ID on the hour. But it is definite that this is the station I heard, the first time I've heard it as far west as Cleveland. Medium wave propagation has been good lately, and that might account for the decent reception. Given the language, it was hard to copy details, but the station is known to have an address and a website. The address is 383 Kingston Avenue, Suite 94, Brooklyn, New York, 11213. Email address from the website is radiomoshiach@erols.com, but I've seen no reports of QSLs from that. The website is www.radiomoshiach.org. I already spelled it. They have streaming audio on the website if you want to know what it sounds like. You're listening to Continent of Media 0510. Our address, WORADIO@yahoo.com or P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK 73702 USA. Much more at our website, worldofradio.com. On the ABDX list, November 12th, Brent Taylor of Doaketown, New Brunswick, wrote about his visit across the border to WBCQ in Maine. Jeff Rivet and I, half of the Miskou DX crew, paid a visit to WBCQ and WREM in Monticello, Maine. The place is fantastic. Al Wiener was away getting more radio stuff in Rochester, New York, but his able cohort, Mike Scheitman, childhood friend and early co-conspirator in the Yonkers days, gave generously of his time and allowed us to tour the site. It's a fantastic place with vintage radio equipment strewn everywhere, stored in buses, trailers, barns, garages, and some just sitting outdoors in the weather. All of WBCQ's transmitters are in fairly modern facilities, though the transmitters themselves are classics from decades ago. WREM on 710 is running from older gear in a separate building, feeding a tower over 400 feet high. I rolled tape on Mike during the visit and have over an hour of narrated tour audio. Jeff and I took copious pictures inside and out. We visited the studio for WBCQ in a trailer and powered by a wind generator. The transmitters are powered from the local utility, but it does not offer three phase power down that road. So all the transmitters have been modified to run from single-phase power. Yikes. We arrive back in Canada, and I'll spend some time transcribing some of the commentary and editing the pictures. The plan is to do an article for publication, perhaps Monitoring Times. The contraptions we saw and photograph belong in many museums. On his October 31st Northeast Radio Watch, Scott Feibusch had a long piece about WCRB, Charles River for Sale. Here is part of it. While it may strike terror into the souls of classical music aficionados across eastern New England, the news that Charles River Broadcasting has put its station group up for sale is anything but a Halloween prank. The board of directors agreed to hire Media Services Group to explore the sale of some or all of its five stations, including classical WCRB 102.5 Waltham. The move appeared at first glance to contradict the wishes of Theodore Jones, the station's founder. At the time of his death in 1991, it was widely reported that he had created a trust structure to ensure that WCRB would remain classical for the next 99 years, leading many in the business to believe that the station, with only one of a dozen or so truly full-market Boston FM signals, would never go up for sale. Charles River, however, sees things differently. Company officials say it's become impossible to operate as a small group in the era of consolidation and clusters, and tell the Globe that when Jones died, the trust he created stated that it was his wish that WCRB remain classical, but not a binding order. The board believes it can honor that wish by mandating that anyone buying WCRB maintain the classical format on an HD radio sub-channel, leaving them free to program whatever they like on the main channel. If that's the case, it could put WCRB in Boston in the same boat as so many other communities where commercial classical radio has either disappeared completely in the last decade, Philadelphia, Miami, Detroit, or has been relegated to a lower power FM or even AM signal, Cleveland, Kansas City, San Diego, and Albuquerque. The M Street database now lists only 27 commercial classical stations in the U.S., including the three Charles River zones. That list, in turn, includes a number of stations owned by nonprofit organizations, KFUO FM in St. Louis, King FM in Seattle, by municipalities, WRR FM in Dallas, or by companies as concerned with the PR value of the station as with profit, the New York Times WQXR FM. Only three commercial broadcast groups of any substantial size own commercial classical outlets in large markets: Bonneville with WGMS in Washington and KDFC in San Francisco, Entercom with KXTR AM in Kansas City, and Saga with WFMR in Milwaukee. He then goes on to speculate about who might be interested in purchasing WCRB. Or, this is purely speculative, could some sort of nonprofit ownership coalesce to preserve the format? The Boston Symphony Orchestra is already a part owner of Charles River. Its counterpart in Seattle is a key player in the nonprofit that owns King FM. Then there's WGBH, which continues to have a commitment to classical music, even as it tries to balance other programming on its FM outlet. The big ticket here is clearly 102.5 in Boston. Anytime a big signal like WCRB is in play in a top 10 market, the stakes are pretty high. And a follow-up from the November issue of FM Media. Longtime classical operator Woody Tanger is interested in buying WCRB. He tried to acquire the full Class B signal years ago and was rebuffed, but now the board of Charles River Broadcasting is exploring options for WCRB, plus its other New England stations and tower operations. Another Boston story. Remember Dick Gordon, who used to do a show called The Connection, originating at WBUR? Brent Taylor in Ontario forwards a story from the newsobserver.com in North Carolina that Dick Gordon has been hired to host a new nationally syndicated talk show beginning early in 06 on WUNC-FM in Chapel Hill. Remember Gary Bourgeois, who used to do a segment on the shortwave DX program Spectrum and also did a Friday night live show? He was the guru of satellite reception. He recently died, and Mike Cooper forwards this, which appeared on the website of Global Communications. By the way, although he pronounced it Bourgeois, his name was spelled B-O-U-R-G-O-I-S. November 17th, it is with great regret we announce that Gary Bourgeois has passed away after years of struggle with health problems. Gary died on November 16th from complications of failure of the liver. He'd been in very poor health in recent months and had been transferred to a nursing care facility in Marquette, Michigan, during his final days. Anyone enjoying the bounty of satellite TV and radio programming now available owes a great debt to Gary. Often misunderstood, he was a champion of our rights to receive whatever was available from the sky. Despite many legal battles with the city of Marquette, he prevailed in his struggle to put up as many antennas as he felt necessary on the walls in the backyard and on a formidable ranger tower at the end of his driveway. This author had the privilege of setting up a number of those antennas, which fed a mountain of reception equipment indoors, racks of equipment so crammed together that electronics often failed from overheating. Addition of air conditioning to the upstairs electronics area helped make things livable. I have memories of doing all-night marathons and sweating like crazy, even though it might have been 50 above outside, and this was Marquette. The utility bills were quite impressive, and the excess heat from the electronics probably helped reduce the actual amount of money for heating itself. You had to be there or visit on one of the few gatherings in Gary's front yard and porch, usually around Labor Day weekend, when satellite geeks everywhere could join in and watch our live telecasts. From that same porch in midwinter, the snow could be 10 feet deep, and a literal tunnel, or very narrow as well as deep path, to the street. The antennas up on the tower were in a natural wind zone and were subject to some brutal treatment from Mother Nature during the winter. It gave Gary something to talk about. I don't remember anyone trying to one-up him in the bad weather and suffering department. Gary joined the computer hobbyists with satellite hobbyists. Starting before we really had a functional internet, he wrote prolific amounts of information, including many how-to-do articles on scrounging satellite equipment to make a very cheap system for the beginning hobbyist. On his weekly Friday night live show, which was telecast around the world at some points, until internet audio became a reality, Gary read the news about satellite and technology, various forms of electronic media, and often what he talked about could be added to news of the weird. He had a unique perspective on religion, greatly disliking the cons that many organized churches plagued their parishioners with. His remains were cremated and will be distributed in places known only to one person, out of respect to Gary's wishes. No services, several satellite radio talk shows were going to dedicate the next few days to his memory. Well, since much of this was in the first person, let's find out who actually wrote it. According to the website, it's Mike Cole, K-O-H-L. On the IRCA list, Bob Foxworth in Florida writes this. The New York Times reported November 9th, in an article by Scott Shane, that the government is creating the Open Source Center to gather and analyze information from the web, broadcasts, newspapers, and other unclassified sources around the world. This is part of the intel restructuring being done by the new DNI, John Negroponte, in recognizing that critical information requires neither spies nor satellites to collect. Not that one would remark, what took them so long? When I read this, I immediately thought of our old buddies at FBIS, who have been around now for decades. The article then mentions that the Foreign Broadcast Information Service is being absorbed into the new center. Examples of open source given in the article are such as sermons from radical mosques, reports in the Chinese provincial press of avian flu outbreaks. The article stresses twice that such material has often been undervalued by government policymakers, in part because it lacks the cachet of information gathered by more sensitive methods. Open source, then, by definition, is any intel that could be gathered by an average person using traditional methods, newspapers or radios. All they need is the means to aggregate it, store it, and reduce it, and then start data mining and looking for associations. Former Assistant CIA Director Mark Lowenthal related a case in point when the Indian government exploded a nuclear device in 1998 which caught Western analysts by surprise, based on their use of agents, eavesdropping, and satellite photos. All they would have had to do is to read the published platform of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, which stated that they would do so if elected. The role of FBIS has expanded beyond simple broadcast monitoring and now covers study of websites, periodicals, and cataloging of slogans seen on T-shirts worn by young people in target countries. Douglas Naquin, FBIS director, will assume command of the OSC, which will be sited at Langley, Virginia, and ultimately under control of Negroponte. This will assure that output from OSC will reach all 15 intel agencies and military commands, and not just the CIA as before. Harry Helms replies, I think there is already something like this. It's called Google. Bob Foxworth replies to that, of course there is Google. We unwashed heathen rabble milling noisily in the streets already know this. But somehow the info passing through Google does or may not have the imprimatur of having been collected in a controlled, documentable way, even if the original source is the same, or worse, can't be determined. I think that this way somehow the info is more credible, even if it is the provincial People's Daily from Hebei province that initially provides the info. And then someone needs to grind all this info together and reduce it to some sort of trend predictor and filter out the noise. I know it may not make sense, but it will provide a nice living for a few hundred more citizens, if nothing else. I'd not be surprised if those working there will have to have a top-secret clearance. Aggregated info can be classified, even if assembled all from originally open sources. Top-secret clearance costs about $50,000 and takes a sesquiterpene. And I imagine a lot of it will be in Arabic. That's Continent of Media 0510, also known as World of Radio Extra 64. I'm Glenn Hauser.